Let's turn in our Bibles to Philippians chapter 1. There are many descriptions of a Christian. I think one is that it's a person who lives between two worlds. That is, we're well grounded on earth. We ought to be responsible. At the same time, we are heaven bound. Because of that fact, there is a tension that is part of our lives. Sometimes we even wonder, like Paul does here in the verses we're about to read, am I in the right place? Wouldn't it just be a whole lot better to be in heaven? Has there been a mix-up, God? There was a bank in Binghamton, New York, that sent flowers to a competitor bank who had just moved locations into a new building, and they wanted to congratulate them. So they sent flowers, but there was a mix-up at the flower shop, and the card that was attached to their bouquet said, "With our deepest sympathies," which kind of threw the bank. What's the message they're trying to get across? Well, they told the flower shop. The florist was embarrassed and apologized, but he was even more embarrassed when he discovered the card that was intended to go to the bank went to the funeral home, so that somewhere in that city was a casket with a beautiful arrangement of flowers in front of it with a card that read, "Congratulations on your new location." I think the church at Philippi, to whom Paul writes this letter, thought there was some mix-up. Maybe God got his wires crossed. They wanted to send Paul a sympathy card. "We're so sorry, we found out you're in jail." And Paul writes back and says, "Oh no, I'm in a new location by the will of God. I'll be just fine." Yet, Paul does long and wrestle with this desire for what he knows lies up ahead in his life. We do too. We're sort of somewhere between what Jesus said, "Occupy till I come, get busy, be responsible," and what John said, "Even so, come quickly, Lord Jesus." And it seems that the more you know about where you're going, you sound a lot more like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. "There's no place like home. There's no place like home." Except you can't just click your heels three times and you're there. And so we go through this struggle between two worlds, between earth and heaven. There's a monument in Spain where Christopher Columbus died. He died in the year 1506, but there's this the commemorative display about his life. And one of the most interesting things about this commemorative statue is that there's a lion that is tearing one of the words out of the motto that Spain had for many years. See, before Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue, Spain believed they were the last part of the world. It was the last outpost. There was nothing beyond it. And so the motto of Spain was, in Latin, "Ne plus ultra," which meant no more beyond. This is it. There's nothing beyond this. In that commemorative statue is a lion tearing away the first word, "nay" or "no," so that it now reads "plus ultra." There is more beyond. Paul knows there's more beyond. And knowing that, he is struggling between life and death when it comes to his own personal desire. And what this section shows us, beginning in verse 22, and we're going to read down to verse 26 in chapter 1, is how to live between those two worlds. There's some lessons in how to face our future. Three words describe it: wrestling, wanting, and willing. Somebody mentions first service. I should have called this message www.paul, but I didn't. Let's begin in verse 22, and I think you'll sense what he's wrestling with. "But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose I cannot tell. For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you for your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again. You can just sense that he's wrestling with something. It's sort of like The Fiddler on the Roof. Do you remember that movie? It's a classic. It's a long movie, but it's great. The central character in the film is Tavia. He's the dad. And Tavia goes through these interesting mental wranglings. He'll talk about the future and about his daughter getting married, and he'll say, on one hand, this could be good, but on the other hand, and he goes back and forth through the movie like this. It's quite cute. Well, Paul does this here. He knows that God is sovereign. He knows that he can't choose life or death like that. But he's sort of mentally wrestling and emotionally going to set himself on one track or the other. Now, we've already seen from a couple weeks ago that Paul handles problem circumstances very well. He wants to go to Rome, but he ends up in a Roman prison, not what he anticipated. And yet he says, well, the gospel's still being furthered, no problem. We go, wow, that's pretty good, Paul. That's amazing. You could resign yourself to that. Then we saw a few verses after that how he handles problem people, Christian troublemakers, who are preaching the gospel with the wrong motivation. He says, I just rejoice that Christ is being preached. And once again, we applaud and we go, you are amazing. But here we get into the deepest part of his heart. Those things are still weighing on him. It's still not easy. And we see the wrestling match. Life, death. In lieu of these problems, to be with Christ. Wow. That could be better. Look in verse 22. He says, what I shall choose, I cannot tell. The word choose, gnorizo in Greek, means literally to reveal. So that what he's really saying is that I'm not quite sure that God has revealed what's going to happen to me. I think it's going to be this. In fact, toward the end of the verse, he says, I'm confident that I'm going to stay. That's kind of where I'm settling in this wrestling match. But I'm not quite sure which is best. And then look at verse 23. I am hard pressed between the two. We would say, I'm between a rock and a hard place. Literally, he's saying, I'm hemmed in on two sides. The word picture that Paul uses in this sentence is the picture of a traveler walking down a path, and on either side of the path, a narrow path, by the way, would be a stone wall. And they're quite common in Israel. If you were to walk from the top of the Mount of Olives down into the Garden of Gethsemane, you're on a narrow path with walls on either side, and those walls sort of press you, it feels like. You're kept in the middle. What Paul is saying is that I've got these two walls in my life. One wall is the wall of personal desire, what I want in light of my circumstances I'm suffering. The other wall is what other people need out of my life in light of their circumstances. And so I'm between those two pressure points of what I want versus what people need. Now, whenever we're caught in a confining spot in our lives, whenever our options are reduced, whenever we're imprisoned by a circumstance, we start thinking about our options. It might be the loss of a spouse or a loved one to death. It might be the loss of a career. It might be the death of a vision. It might be a personal illness you face. And you start thinking, what can I do? We have to be very careful in making those kinds of choices in those critical moments because they can be dangerous. It's really all about our motivation. Paul's motivation was Christ. If I live, Christ. If I die, Christ. We saw that last week. A lot of times, however, if you're honest, our motivation is I'm going to make a choice not based upon Christ, but based upon moi, my personal relief. I haven't got time for the pain. I want to make some relief-causing choice. But Paul lived between those two walls, always deciding, eventually, as we'll see today, to glorify Jesus Christ. Now, sometimes we become fatalistic. That the reasoning is something like this. Life stinks right now. It's pretty hard. It'd be a whole lot better to die. I'd rather be in heaven. Being in heaven is a whole lot better than any experience on earth. Now, if we think like that, we can become fatalistic and even suicidal. A lot of people think like that just before they commit suicide. So it's a dangerous place to be, and that's why we need to weigh our motivations. Paul, thinking about his motivations, wants to glorify Jesus Christ, as I said. He's not fatalistic. It's not a morbid desire like an Alfred Hitchcock movie, Death. It's something different. Now, sometimes people don't become fatalistic when they think about life or death, heaven or earth. They become rather materialistic. This is usually when life is going good for them. It's not constrained. It's like, okay, being in heaven or being on earth, oh, I'll postpone heaven, man. I'm going to go on a vacation next week. I don't want to go to heaven right now. We're building a new house. Heaven can wait. I remember a girl that I knew in California, and she was a believer. We were talking about the soon return of the Lord Jesus, which should cause every believer to go, yes. And she said to me, you know what? If Jesus comes back before I have a chance to get married, I'm going to be mad. Hello? Do you know what that means, the return of the Lord, for you personally? Paul did. That's why Paul could say, life, fruitfulness, death, being with Jesus. Let's turn to that now. Let's look at the next verse, verse 23. The second W, he's wanting to depart. For I'm hard-pressed between the two. Notice, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. This is how Paul views his death. It's not how he views everybody's death, but it's how he views his own personal death. And I would say we have a great description in this verse of the death of a believer. But I want you to notice the word desire. It's a strong word. In fact, it might shock you as I tell you what it means. The Greek word for desire is epithumia, which is the normal word in the Bible for the word lust. It's usually translated the lust of the flesh, the epithumia, a burning desire. Here it's used in a very good sense, however. I have a craving, burning desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. In verse 23, we have a great description of what it is for a Christian to pass from this earth and go to heaven. First of all, it will be a departure. That's how he describes it, a desire to depart. The word means to break up, to loose, or to undo something. And you'd be interested, I think, to know that in the ancient times, Greco-Roman society, the word that is translated depart was used one of three ways. All of them speak of beautiful way the Christian departs this world. First of all, departure meant to break camp, to move on. When a Roman army was advancing and they would set up their tents, there would come a time when the order would come and the commander would say, it's time to get on the move. They'd pull up the stakes. They'd roll up the tents and they'd move on. It's like us, right? We're pilgrims. We're on the move. We're camping out here. We're on earth, but it's not permanent. It's just temporary. We're in a tent. And one day we're going to pull up the stakes and we're going to move on. Now, I love to camp. It's great to set up the tent. My son loves it. As fun as it is, I don't like it for long. If you were to tell me, hey, let's go on a 3-month camp, I go, think again. I don't think so. After just a few days, it's beautiful out there, but you know, you start smelling different. You start missing things. Like, let's say, a bed, a shower. So it's temporary. The longer you live in this tent, this body of flesh, you notice a few things about it. You notice it's temporary, don't you? You do, because we're always trying to fix it. I was looking in the mirror this morning at the threads and the flaps. I'm thinking, yep, it's temporary. It's not going to last very long. And one day we're going to pull up the stakes and we're going to depart. We're going to move on. That's how Paul described it. 2 Corinthians 5, he says, we know that when this earthly tent that we live in is taken down, when we die and leave these bodies, we will have a home in heaven, an eternal body made for us by God, not by human hands. Sort of interesting that while we as believers know that we're just living in temporary tents, we live in a society that is preoccupied with tents. We do whatever we can to keep this tent, and almost as if we think it's going to live forever. They won't. There's nothing wrong with doing the best with what you have, but you are going to depart one day. You compare the philosophy of our culture, make the tent look good. How do you like my tent? Compare that with verse 20. Last week we read it. Paul said, whatever I do by life or death, I want to make sure I magnify Christ in my body. I want my body to glorify Christ. We live in a culture that glorifies the body. And we'll take the flaps and we'll stretch them way back so it looks like we're younger. And that thinking even goes at the beyond death. I've stood at funerals and watched people look in the casket and they go, boy, he looks good. Who cares? He's departed. Oh, but he looks good. But give him a month. It's a tent. It's designed for something temporary. It's over. And if he's a believer, he's moved. He's pulled up stakes. It's a lot better. Also, the word depart, anelusai, was a word that was used for setting sail, undoing the anchor, and letting the ship catch the wind and arrive at another port. And so Paul writes to Timothy toward the very end of his life, and he says, the time of my departure is at hand. See you, Timothy. I'm sailing. That's why some of the old Christian hymns speak of meeting together on that distant shore. We're sailing. F.B. Meyer, he's a Bible commentator. Before he died, he wrote a friend a letter. And the letter said, I've just heard to my great surprise that I have but a few days to live. It may be that before this letter reaches you, I shall have entered the palace. Don't bother to write. We shall meet in the morning. Isn't that great? See you later. Adios. I'm sailing. A third way the word depart was used in ancient Greco-Roman times, to relieve the burden or to end the work. It was the taking off the yoke from the oxen that plowed the fields. They'd be yoked together. They'd plow all day long. And at the end of the day, the yoke would depart. The same word was used. Untie the oxen. Take off the burden. And there'll come a time when we pass from this life and lay down our burdens and hear the Lord Jesus say to us, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord. That's the payoff. So, death will be a departure. Paul says, I'm wanting to depart. Also, death will be an encounter. Notice the next part of that verse. Having a desire to depart and be with Christ. Now, there's the difference between the death of a believer and a non-believer. It's not just a departure. It's an arrival. It's an encounter. It's a meeting together. And who are we going to be with? Jesus. I want to be with Christ, Paul said. No question, as you read Paul's letters, who he loved more than anybody else on earth. His best friend. The person he hung out with the most, Jesus Christ. Which is interesting because Paul hated Jesus at one time. He was trying to imprison and kill people who believed in him until the Damascus Road experience, his own conversion. And he's lying flat on his back. And the first question is, who are you, Lord? The second question, when he finds out it's Jesus, what do you want me to do? From that moment on, he spent his whole life finding out what Jesus wanted him to do and did it. and talked about him and wrote about him and prayed to him. And so he says, I'm going to depart and be with Christ. There will be an encounter. And that's how we ought to think of heaven. It's not just, oh, we're leaving this earth, we're going to play harps on a cloud somewhere. No, we're going to encounter Christ. And by the way, you're going to encounter all of the people who have walked with Christ on this earth. There'll be a reunion. Isn't that cool? There was a man who confessed that when he was younger, he was a believer. He said, when I used to hear about heaven, I thought of it in such impersonal terms. I thought heaven is this big place tucked away somewhere. It's lofty and almost cold. It's got gold streets and gates of pearl and a river of life. He said, until my young daughter died and went there. Then I started thinking of heaven as a big, beautiful place with gold streets and gates of pearl and a river of life with one little girl waiting to see me. And I couldn't wait to see her. Then he said, as life went on, my wife died. My son died. Parents died. Friends died. He said, you know, by the end of my life, I think I know more people who live in heaven than live on earth. I think of it wholly different. There's going to be a reunion. And the greatest reunion is you'll be with Jesus Christ face to face. The one we talk about, pray to, worship. Ah, there he is. What a great difference, once again, between the unbeliever who departs from this earth and tries to make this all there is, and the believer who says, ah, but if I depart, I'm going to be with Jesus. And I've mentioned to you before, and I think last week, I've watched lots of people die, unbelievers and believers, and they die radically different. Basically, the unbeliever dies saying, I'm leaving. And the believer goes, I'm coming home. I'm not leaving home, I'm coming home. When Voltaire died, the French atheist, and he was pretty smug in his philosophy through his life, his atheistic antichrist philosophy. Yet when he died, he was on his deathbed through the night, and he cried out for hours, the reports say, saying, oh, Christ, oh, Jesus Christ, I am in torment, I am in the flames, I shall go to hell, he said. The nurse who attended his death said for all the money in Europe, she would never want to witness the death of another unbeliever ever again. And there are many other stories like that. But listen to some believers who have died. Martin Luther said on his deathbed, our God is the God from whom cometh salvation. God is the Lord by whom we escape death. John Knox said, live in Christ, live in Christ, and the flesh need not fear death. John Wesley, the evangelist, said, the best of all, God is with us. Farewell, farewell. His brother Charles Wesley said, I shall be satisfied with thy likeness. And he died saying, satisfied, satisfied. What a great way to leave and to arrive. John Newton, rugged sailor, converted at sea, who wrote Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound, on his deathbed said, I'm like a person going on a journey in a stagecoach, who expects its arrival every hour and is frequently looking out of the window for it. I'm packed and sealed and ready for the post. Ready to go. I've mentioned to you Dwight L. Moody in the past, the evangelist, the beginning of this century, latter part of last century. He was preaching a crusade. It was the end of his life. And he was sick, so he had to cut it short. And he told his family, I'm not discouraged. I want to live as long as I'm useful. But when my work is done, I want to be up and off. He went to bed that night, had a very restless sleep. And he woke up and with very deliberate words said to his family, Earth is receding. Heaven opens before me. His son, Will, who was at his deathbed, thought, Dad's dreaming. He said, Dad, wake up, you're dreaming. And Dwight L. Moody said to his son, No, this is no dream, Will. It's beautiful. It's like a trance. If this is death, it's sweet. There's no valley here. God is calling me and I must go. God's calling me. It's going to be a departure. It's going to be an encounter. And third, as Paul says, it's going to be better. Notice the words in both in verse 21 and in 23. He says, to die is gain. And then in verse 23, which is far better. In Greek, it's actually three words. Much more better. I want to depart and be with Christ, which is much more better. Boy, that's bad English. But it's good Greek. And it's great theology. Much more better. Now, Paul could say that because he was the guy who was caught up into the third heaven, 2 Corinthians tells us. And he saw heaven. He said, I saw stuff that was unlawful for a man to utter. It's indescribable. What he saw was like, this is cool. This is far better. So he looked at death very differently. And he knew that there is never a moment when he is out of the conscious presence of God. Folks, if you're a believer, when you die, you're not going to go into some holding tank, a soul sleep, or limbo, or purgatory. You'll be directly in the presence of God. Paul said to be absent from the body is to be present with Christ. You're not going to be floating around somewhere, waiting for a reincarnation. You'll be with Christ, and that's why he said it's far better. Look at verse 24 now, the third W in our message. He's wrestling with the predicament. He's wanting to depart, but he is willing to remain. Let's notice why. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. You see, Paul's hemmed between those two walls. What he wants in light of his situation, he's suffering. What they need in light of their situation, they're growing believers. So nevertheless, to remain is more needful for you. By the way, here's a mark of a mature believer. Here's the mark of a spiritual man or woman. Spiritual man or woman will weigh what he wants against what other people need, and they'll make the right choice. They'll make choices not just, it's about me. It's about what I want. It's about what I need. I'm the center of the universe. No, he'll say, I could help other people. So I'm going to make a choice, not just based on personal relief, but what's the best thing for those people that are in my life? That's what he's going through. That's what he's dealing with. And Paul practiced that. Look over in chapter 2 of Philippians. In verse 3, he sort of expands on the thought. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. But he lived that. He just didn't write about it. He just didn't preach it. He practiced. He said, okay, you know, I'd rather just die and depart and be with Christ. Pick up the stakes, set sail, take off the yoke. Ah, far better. However, I could stay and get a lot done. I could be, first of all, fruitful. Verse 22. If I live on in the flesh, that is, the flesh of my body, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I cannot tell. Paul knew, if I'm going to live, if I'm going to hang around this earth and be in this old body, I'm going to do one thing with it. I'm going to labor for Christ. I'm going to be fruitful. What does that mean? We talk about bearing fruit as a believer. Well, there's a lot of ways the Bible speaks about being fruitful. Winning converts to Christ is one way. Paul wrote to the Romans in chapter 1 of Romans, and he said, I often plan to come to you that I might have some fruit among you, just as among other Gentiles. That's Romans 1:13. But then fruit is also seen as holy living, godly character. Romans 6:22, he said, having been set free from sin, having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life. So it's people one to Christ. It's holy, godly, living character. A third way fruit is used is giving of your resources, of your time. In Romans 15, Paul spoke of the contribution to the saints, and he calls it this fruit. This money that you're giving to the saints in Jerusalem is fruit. Another means, and I'm giving you all these because some preachers will tell you, you want to be fruitful, give. Or win people to Christ. And all of that is fruit. There's not just one thing. Fruit is also seen as good works. Colossians 1:10. Pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work. And finally, fruit is the fruit of our lips. Praise. Hebrews 13:15. Let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God. That is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks unto His name. Fruit is what your life produces. Is it good fruit? Is it bad fruit? Jesus said you can tell a tree by its fruit. You don't have to walk up to an apple tree and expect a big sign hung, apple tree. You look at the apples. If there's oranges on it, don't think it's an apple tree. And so how do you tell a Christian's a Christian? By fruit, by what comes from their lives. It's not by what they claim they are. It's not by what bumper sticker they place on the back of their car. It's not by the fact that I speak in tongues three times a day. It's by the fruit of their lives. John Stott said, the Christian should resemble a fruit tree, not a Christmas tree. For the gaudy decorations of a Christmas tree are only tied on, whereas fruit grows on a fruit tree. There's one other word in verse 22 I want to draw your attention to. Second one. But if. If. Small word. I think that sort of sums up our future. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. I think the point is clear. Life is tentative. It's an if. Now, I know you might have plans for your life. You have planned to move, have children, go to college perhaps, or have your kids go to college. But the honest truth is, it's all an if. You really don't know how long you'll live or die, neither do I. But here's the point. Since life is tentative, the time to bear fruit and labor for Christ is right now. Not when I depart, but now. So that the departure is sweet. Fruitfulness. Second reason Paul thought remaining, and he was willing to do so, was the option is it would be progressive to their faith. Verse 25. Being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you for the progress and joy of your faith, or of faith. That your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again. You know, I'd rather just be in heaven, said Paul. That's my desire. But I'm hemmed by that other thing, what you need. And what you need is to grow. I want you to grow. And I know that if I stay, I can help you grow. The progress, the word progress means to blaze a trail so that an army can advance. You know, one thing you notice about Paul is he's always thinking about other people. Always thinking about other people. This would be better for you if I stay. He writes to the Romans and he says, I want to visit you because when I'm there, I'm going to impart to you some spiritual gift. He's thinking of others. And therein lies the secret of Paul's joy. He lived to glorify Jesus Christ and he lived to help others grow. That's why he was so joyful. You've seen the acronym before, JOY, J-O-Y, Jesus, others, you. Keep Jesus first, glorify Him, serve others second, and put yourself last and you'll be a happy person. Reverse the order, you'll be pretty miserable. It's pretty easy to tell. It's all about you. Or is it all about Jesus and others? There's joy. We're last. This sort of begs the question. As we read this today and we think about, okay, we see what Paul wanted, but he would stay. Whatever really happened to Paul historically? We know he's in jail here. Well, probably in AD 64, right before the great fire of Rome that destroyed many of its buildings, Paul was released. By the way, Caesar Nero blamed the Christian church for that fire and sought to arrest Christians and persecute them, and Paul was eventually caught again, but he was released before the great fire. And he traveled to Asia Minor, and he visited churches, and he wrote letters, and he strengthened Christians. He traveled to Crete, that island out in the Mediterranean. And he told Titus, you stay here, you strengthen the church. And he moved then on to Ephesus. And he dealt with two heretics, kicked them out of the church, we think, Alexander and Hymenaeus, which he rebuked in a letter. He places Timothy in charge of Ephesus, and then moves on to Troas, where probably he is arrested by the Roman government somewhere between 65 and AD 67. This time he's beheaded. So, am I going to live or die? Well, both. The time that he had to live, he did exactly what he said he would do. He was fruitful. He helped people progress in their faith until the day, in effect, Jesus said, Paul, it's time to come home. It's time to depart. Time to pull up the stakes, set sail, take the yoke off, and be with me, which is far better. And so he died. Now you and I are on our way to heaven. Until you get there, do something. Bear some fruit. Until you get to heaven. Oh great, I'm going to heaven. But until you get there, let's advance like an army. Let's make progress in our faith by living for Jesus, helping others grow in the faith, and spread it around. So ask yourself this question as we close. Am I growing? Are you growing? In fact, let's make it manageable. Can you say in the last 6 months or year of your life, you have made definite progress in your Christian faith? You know, serving the Lord, being a Christian, is sort of like riding a bicycle uphill. I like to mountain bike, do it a few times a week, and I go from my house up toward the mountain. I notice something, that if I stop pedaling, making advanced forward motion, I coast backwards. I lose ground. And if you're not making progress as a believer, I think you're moving backwards. Are you progressing? I took my son to the Albuquerque Aquarium this week. And he loves to see the shark tank. That's his like number one. He loves them. And it's also the most popular exhibit in the aquarium. So we're looking at the sharks. And then later I read about sharks this week and found that sharks adapt in size to their environment. That is, you can take a shark and it will grow depending on the size of the aquarium. You can have a small shark, even 6 inches, and it can be fully grown if it's caught and kept in a confined space. Let it back out in the ocean. It'll grow to its full length, around 8 feet. Interesting. You know, I've met the cutest little 6-inch Christians. They swim around in puddles. Hey, let's swim deeper this year, shall we? Let's go deep out into the ocean. Let's keep going and keep growing. How? Live for the glory of Jesus Christ. Live for other people. And you'll die a happy man or woman. There's an old American Indian saying that says, when you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a manner that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice.